In this episode, I'm going to talk about teaching fusion, nuclear fusion, to year seven or around that area. This is just after they've first entered high school. Now, it's an ambitious goal, but I'm going to have a go at how you would teach it. Now, this is Peter Hill Explains, where I talk about things scientific, and I use the time during my cardiac walk to rehabilitate my mind as well, to get used to speaking aloud. So the idea is that nuclear fusion is the burning which happens inside the sun. So the sun is obviously a major source of heat. It looks like a big fiery ball, but rather than chemical burning, it's actually nuclear burning. So there's a lot of concepts to get across here. Now, that being said, year seven haven't been introduced to atoms, nucleuses, or anything else like that. So the idea is to sort of simplify these ideas, which are usually introduced around year nine, and pitch it at a year seven audience. So we don't have the full architecture to teach year seven. We don't have all the concepts in place. But if you pitch a lesson, even in year nine, which can be comprehended by year seven, you'll have a greater uptake of ideas. So, very basically, fusion is there's a whole heap of protons inside the sun. This is hydrogen protons, and there's about 25% helium inside the sun. This is actually the end product of fusion. Well, most of the end product of fusion, but it's also the end product of the first couple of minutes of the Big Bang. The Big Bang was so intense that nuclear fusion began in earnest in that period, and we've got a lot of Big Bang material left over. So our 25% of helium in the sun is what the 25% of helium in the universe. Now, interestingly, helium has got four times the mass, two protons and two neutrons. A neutron and a proton are about the same mass, so they're four times as heavy as hydrogen. So it actually means that although helium as a species is a minority, as a mass, if you had to actually, if you were shopping and you're filling up your car with the hydrogen and the helium of the universe, that both shopping bags would weigh about the same. Hydrogen would be a bit bulkier and helium would be denser and weigh the same. So that's in our sun, but the fusion occurs when the protons go through a journey to turn into helium, and as they do, they actually stick together, and that sticking energy is released as heat. So that's a fundamental idea. So how do you actually teach it? Now, you have to introduce the idea, a physical idea of a proton to the kids, and the way that you would do that is a fist. Hi, Tim. A fist with your a sort of cupped hand with your thumb on the outside. So if you do that, you've got two protons which can immediately put inside the kid's kid's hands, so to speak. Actually, rather than putting them inside the hands, you can actually put it inside, make their hands. It's not hands on, it's actually hands. I'll sort of stop at the moment. So your left and right hand are protons, and they're the thumbs on the upper side, thumbs on the upper side, and the cupped fingers together, forming a sort of a little hook like a monkey grip. Now, these protons are pushed together and they actually bounce off each other. They bounce off each other. I hope people have been amused by the dogs and various people during this podcast. They bounce off each other and they can't stick to each other. Because to stick to each other, they've got to actually hook hand in hand. Now, you then say, look, besides protons, you need something else, sort of a hook material, and that's a neutron. So you demonstrate the neutron to the child as the hand with thumb pointing down. Now, instantly, they can actually push these two together and get them to lock together. That will form deuterium, or heavy hydrogen. And the actual, you can show the actual click together of the hands releases some energy. So there's a goat. It's all happening around here. So you ram a proton and a neutron together, they can actually stick together by the fingers interlocking and thumb on one hand upwards and thumb on the other hand downwards. You then use, I think, this opportunity to sort of say that neutrons are very special and that they could travel through, they do travel through ordinary matter, much like a ghost. So if you got the students to hold up their hand and you had an imaginary cup of neutrons and you poured it out of the cup, what would happen is that the neutrons wouldn't stop in the hand, it would actually just keep on flowing, floating down to the into the earth. And in fact, this is an actual fact what actually does happen. You have neutron water detectors, and you just pour out your neutrons, let them float into the earth, and when they encounter significant water beneath, they explode or create radiation. And so this is also true for nuclear reactors. The neutrons produced at one point just float through the normal matter of the nuclear reactor to the uranium on the other side. You then have to develop this further to get to helium. And so what you do is that you clip the proton and neutron together to make deuterium. Just displace the hands a tiny amount, such there's a bit of a hook at the top of one of the hands. So the left hand is, say, two fingers displaced from the right hand. And what can happen, so I'm just a bit out of breath going up this hill, what can happen is that the a partner can come along and lock his deuterium onto the other person's deuterium and make a helium. Now, of course, the actual process is far more complex than that. In the production of, we go through a helium-3 stage and then to helium-4. So that gives an overall idea of how nuclear fusion works. You're actually getting the nucleuses and fusing them together by the production of neutrons. Now, at some stage here, you have the question you start off with. You start off with protons, which are positively charged nuclei, and how you need neutrons from somewhere. Where do the neutrons come? And of course, the neutrons get converted. So the protons get converted into neutrons. Now, this process is by, this is getting a bit deep here, it's by the weak force, and essentially the creation of a neutron from a proton also requires the production of a positron and a balancing neutrino. So that step requires production, and that positron will then annihilate with an electron, but you'll have the neutrino escape the star. Now, the neutrino is a very light mass electron, or it's in the same family, the lepton family, and to produce neutrinos, or to produce electrons, you just can't produce an electron out of nothing. The symmetry demands that you have to actually produce a neutrino as well. So all these nuclear reactions produce these neutrinos. So as neutrons can actually just be dropped and drop through things. So the Americans have developed neutron bombs, which are sort of a rather benign mechanical explosion, but produces heaps of neutrons, and these neutrons will penetrate armour, everything. One thing they won't penetrate, of course, is when they slow down, they won't penetrate water, because what they do is these neutrons love hooking up and sticking to nuclei. So they transmute nuclei, but they really love sticking to the hydrogen of water. So if you have concrete, for instance, that's actually fairly high density water. Now, concrete basically is a salt, hydrated salt. And one of the people, I suppose, going into it, one of the misconceptions is that concrete dries. Well, it sort of does dry, but it doesn't evaporate. The water actually binds into the salt, producing hydrated salt. There's a big massive Australian coal train going up. Take the coal. It's pretty amazing that they mine coal at one section and haul it right across the through the Blue Mountains to power stations on the other side. It's pretty amazing how they do that. So that's that noise noise there. So I suppose the really interesting thing is that as neutrons are outside, definitely high school science teachers' understanding, they sort of look at you very suspiciously when you say, oh, look, a neutron can travel through normal matter. And they will tend to go back and say, oh, look, my teacher told me, my barber. So they go into that zone of reflecting, not look, reading books, not doing anything else, but that zone of where you have a person in authority has told them that neutrons can't go through normal matter. So as neutrons can go through normal matter and flow through, particularly cold neutrons, they will bind and stick with water. Now, I'm just going to digress here for a moment. Neutrons are pretty interesting beasts in that they tend to feel the strong nuclear force and actually glue and stick like a little bomb into nucleuses. So the neutrons actually float out through the uranium when it splits, and the neutrons then make the uranium more radioactive, and this gives you a chain reaction. But moving back into the more mundane world, if you've got a high-speed neutron, look, quantum mechanics tells you, and you can understand, that the more energetic things are smaller and the slower things expand in size. So neutrons, try and get this around your head, forget this Year 7 lesson, neutrons actually expand in size or effective cross-section as they slow down. So it's actually slowing down a neutron makes it super sticky, so it can actually get in and lock into nucleuses and create periodic table magic as you suddenly are able to play snakes and ladders in the periodic table. Now, this slowing down is a critical thing for neutrons to become useful tools for science. And there's a very famous experiment in that Enrico Fermi, famous Italian refugee physicist who was working in, I think, Chicago, had an experiment where he had a neutron source. I don't know whether it's... I have to think exactly what the neutron source was. He would stick other elements next to it and try and see what those neutrons did. He was making some great progress. And what happened is he took it off his, I think, marble laboratory bench and put it on a sort of a makeshift wooden bench. And as soon as he put it on the wooden bench, the experiment began to work. Yeah, so the wood, put it on a wooden bench, it worked. On a marble bench, which has the neutrons have to sort of are spraying in all directions, go through normal matter, they don't slow down the marble, but when you put them on a wooden bench, there's wood has a lot of water and carbon in it. This slowed down the neutrons, and he suddenly got much greater reactions. Now, the next idea is that when at the time the Germans reported the splitting of the atom, splitting of the nucleus, the splitting of the nucleus and producing more neutrons, there was a possibility that a nuclear reaction which produces neutrons is ideal, because you can then slow these neutrons down and actually get a reaction happening. And so this is rather a strange thing that he then got a lot of the United States carbon reserves and built a huge table, and actually put the uranium in the center of this huge table. So this is a graphite block, and in the gymnasium he built the first nuclear reactor in a Chicago gymnasium. And for this he was able to monitor the production of uranium. I'm just trying to think. This is he had a neutron poison which dropped down into it. So as he put in the control rods. That's right. As he took out the control rods, which poisoned the neutrons, allowed the neutrons to go, and he was able to produce a whopping 2 watts of energy through nuclear energy. And this was enough for the Americans to say, oh, well, right, let's scale it up and produce an atomic bomb. But there's another story to it. They had the control rods able to drop down into this first nuclear reactor in a university gym, and the rods were held like the sword of Damocles above the nuclear reactor, and if the nuclear reactor was going to go critical, a person would undo the knots and let the rods drop down. And so it was decided that undoing the knots was not fast enough. And so they got a lumberjack, I would expect. Obviously, you'd recruit someone to hold an axe. And so if Enrico Fermi says, whoa, let's stop this one, the axeman would actually cut the ropes and the control rods would drop into the nuclear reactor. And this is called scramming the nuclear reactor, which is stopping it. Now, one of the things we found with scramming the nuclear reactor, it's not just a simple mathematical equation of putting the brakes on and everything dies down. What actually does happen is that you kind of get a sudden nuclear flux, neutron flux increase. And so if you scram the nuclear reactor incorrectly, you can actually blow it up. So there's some aspects of how that occurred in Chernobyl, that sort of misunderstanding about how you scram a reactor. But scram, remembering that there were safety control rods and you had an axe man there ready to release these things. So scramming actually means safety control rod axe man. So getting back into it, that's just a tidbit of information. But so in the sun, there's a large nuclear reaction, and really the reaction occurs very, very slowly. It's taking its time. It'll take about 10 billion years to burn through all the hydrogen and produce it into helium before other processes take over. And so this is getting back away from neutrons. One of the things I wanted to point out is that getting back into the fusion reaction, not only can neutrons just travel effortlessly through normal matter,
and a neutron itself doesn't exist in nature, because a neutron will last, I think, about 3/4 of 900 seconds. I don't know how many, a quarter of an hour, something like that. And then it will suddenly bang and convert itself back into hydrogen. And so what it does is it releases an electron. To compensate that, the actual charge in the nucleus increases +1. You get a hydrogen. A neutrino is produced, because you can't produce an electron without an equal neutrino, and a large characteristic X-ray is produced. Now, I think it's... I have to remember what the energy of... G'day. The energy... Sorry, just seeing a mate in a truck drive past. So this is important in that if you just have free neutrons about the place, the way it sort of is dangerous is that it produces X-rays. And I suppose this is another very interesting thing, is that you have to build your nuclear reactor that neutrons just don't float out of it. It's called a neutron shine, so a very poor quality nuclear reactor. I think there's a few around the world. You take your neutron detector up to it and you can do an inverse square law, not quite, of neutrons which just erupt from the nuclear reactor. And so this is any nuclear reactor which is above ground level. You can get neutron shine from it. But associated with neutrons are these neutrinos. Now, neutrinos don't interact there with strong nuclear force, so there is really nothing to stop them. A neutrino can actually travel through a light year. So that's a lot of lead before it impacts. And the sun is actually producing, streaming out billions of neutrinos, and they're just racing through my body. Say, if I've got the sun above me, will race through the core of the Earth and out through some other person who's on the other side of the Earth. Who's on the other side of the Earth? I think somewhere in America or Atlantic somewhere. Will race through that person and out into space, those neutrinos. And they're pouring. So for each nuclear reaction, you get actually a fair number of neutrinos produced in the steps along the way. And these particles as well travel very quick. Now, I'm yet to fully understand about the speed of neutrinos, but as with quantum mechanics, the lighter it is, the bigger it is. So electrons are actually... in terms of volume, bigger than protons. Neutrinos are much, much larger than anything else. So I've done a few calculations. I think actually a neutrino, if you could see it, would be the size of a grape. Some calculations I've done for a neutrino at reasonable, comprehensible speed would be the size of a basketball. It's pretty hard to comprehend. People tend to say, oh no, that's not true, but we are actually rained with all these neutrinos coming through us. And of course the neutrinos are from fusion. From fission you get a different sort of neutrinos. In fact, you can actually tell what sort of nuclear reaction is happening from different types of nuclear reactions. So we can actually monitor nuclear reactors, and you can't shield from neutrinos because they travel through each other. So we can tell by neutrino detectors pretty well what's happening around the place. Now, I suppose a large source of natural neutrinos, neutrons, is there's very few neutrons produced by spontaneous nuclear decay. So the neutrons on Earth are that we have been showered with all the time, the natural neutrons come from... cosmic ray interaction with the atmosphere. So we have these very high powered particles which are accelerated by magnetic fields and explosions, and they race like veritable bullets, and when they smash into the nucleus completely disintegrates into protons and neutrons and showers the place with neutrons. Now, this is rather an interesting thing, is that people are trying to say, well, look, my neutron detector goes off when there's some lightning. And so that would tend to indicate that the lightning is producing neutrons. And doing the calculations, it's very hard to work out how that could happen. But it's turned out the opposite sort of sense, that lightning is often sparked by a cosmic ray, which produces neutrons and also produces the lightning. And so if you like, you've got the lightning on Earth, is the atmosphere is a gigantic radiation Geiger counter. It's pretty amazing to understand that the entire Earth is a radiation detector, and the clicks are lightning pulses. But getting back to it, you've got the neutrons, and where you can build the understanding, and whether the understanding that you build in children about fusion will interfere with their understanding of chemical reactions in which the nucleuses stay the same, but they can get closer to each other by rearrangement of electrons. So what I like about this particular activity, getting back to the activity, you have your thumb on top is a proton, thumb underneath is a neutron, and when it's like that, a neutron and a proton can stick together, and you can get an energy release when the two stick together, as the hands click together. And so I like that's a very physical thing, that they've actually got their hands there in a state. It's basically programming their short-term memory, because they mightn't remember anything, but they can look down at their hands and work out what's going on. And then you have a group activity where two students have to get together to form helium. In order to do that, they have to cooperate and communicate what's going on. And so they can see that they start off with four hydrogens, or four protons, and there's this process which goes inside the sun, which actually fuses the two students together. It's pretty amazing. It fuses all their hands and the actual two students together. It's a bit hard to go through. So in terms of a teaching model, using this as a form of teaching, it's got a lot of deep understanding, which you can go through if you understand it, but it's got a very good collection point. It can actually collect a whole series of students of different ability here. So you've always got your advanced student who wants to go really fast, so you should provide for them a standard adult traditional way of teaching so they can get on with that if they turn their nose up at this game. But I suppose the important thing that sort of a measure of success I want to get back to is not whether the student at the end of the day can produce a written equation of four protons goes to a helium plus energy, which is the basic 4P fusion process. So there's 4P and then there's CNO, which is the next fusion process along, a bit more involved. But it's not whether they can produce that and whether they can produce answers. I think it's a very important thing to measure progress, but it's whether that has increased their confidence, and whether that activity, although it may not be successful, has inoculated them or set them up for future learning or opened up greater curiosity there. And I suppose the other tripping points is that if you have the gatekeepers of this learning very much believing in classical physics, and that is the electrons as a tiny little dot, like a fly buzzing around a sausage in a barbecue, they're whizzing around the place. If they've got that firmly in view have a view that excludes the quantum world, where waves can actually travel through each other like sound waves, speaking. And if they've got the view and they've got that next step of aggressively talking down any alternative views beside it, they're not going to let this this thing forward, and they'll stick to a cultivation method of science which precludes opening up up questions. And that's the reality of how it happens. So with all these cooking alternative ideas, I suppose the sort of trying to unlock the barriers and the success criteria is to reshape that success criteria. That's the easiest soft point. You're not going to educate teachers who have been taught all their lives and built their reputations on classical physics. You're going to be able to teach them quantum physics. Well, I haven't so far been able to do that. But the thing that I think the soft area, which is sort of most important for the career development of young minds, is to measure the increase in confidence. Now, and that increase in confidence doesn't occur instantly. It may be subtle behaviours where they're more willing to engage in different ways with materials later on. So, say in several lessons later, you can see that they refer to this style of learning. You've provided several styles of learning, and if they can have this as the base inter-student communication style of learning, and that they are more confident than students who have been exposed to just a very narrow way of learning, which is actually monitored in such a way that sends signals that you measure their understanding. You also inadvertently measure students who haven't yet understood or having a different path towards their understanding. So it's very important that, this measuring technique tends to telegraph to students that they haven't met the standard, and the idea is that they recognise that and they take action. Well, it may well be that the environmental factors necessary for the understanding are beyond our direct measuring understanding. So it may be that they see a documentary or see something else, and they're trying to retrieve that information at a later date and lock it in, and then at that later date understanding exists. So just looking at your path forward, looking at age group, looking at success criteria, and looking at the utility of what you teach the kids. So just to summarise again, say we're teaching how the sun burns. It's actually a nuclear burning. So there is a fuel and an exhaust product as a normal burning. However, in this burning, the nucleuses, which are just normally rearranged, are actually fused together. And you're then able to teach it in lockstep method, showing that showing the processes by getting the hands to not engage, click into neutrons, engage, and then further engage into producing helium. So that's all I have for this podcast. And in the meantime, keep on doing science.